The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on October 19, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Nice to see you all here this morning. Many of you were probably expecting that we were going to have a session today and weren't expecting to be here. we had some illnesses that ended up making our enrollment just too small to have a session, but it does remind me that people who haven't been to a session yet, maybe we can try to get you in there. And then we can have a few people be sick, it won't matter, right? So anyhow, but here we are today. And I'm going to be giving a talk that's titled The Panther. And it is the title of a poem I'll be talking about for my talk by Rainer Rilke, the Austrian poet. And the reason I'm talking about this poem is it's just been on my mind. I don't know why, but it's been coming up. I've been giving talks and suddenly I remember an image from this poem and I thought it'd be nice just to come back to this poem and see what it actually says. And what it says is interesting, and it does have some overlap with Buddhist teaching, so I'll try to draw that out. And that, of course, tells us something about how we live our life. So the poem, The Panther, it's only three stanzas long, so sometimes Rilke's poems can be kind of long. This one's not too bad. I don't know what you call this. It's like a description of the setting, the location of the inspiration for this poem is right after the poem. So it's the poem in the Jardin des Plantes, which was a zoo in Paris. His vision from the constantly passing bars has grown so weary that it cannot hold anything else. It seems to him there are 1,000 bars, and behind the bars, no world. As he paces in cramped circles over and over, the movement of his powerful, soft strides is like a ritual dance around a center in which a mighty will stands paralyzed. Only at times, the curtain of the pupils lifts quietly. An image enters in, rushes down through the tense, arrested muscles, plunges into the heart, and is gone. And that's the poem. So again, Rilke saw this panther in this zoo and it inspired him to look at this. When we think about that image of that panther and he's pacing back and forth between the bars of the cage he's in. So this isn't like the Minnesota Zoo where the animals don't quite, well, depends on where you are. I mean, I was just there kind of recently and there's like cages in the back. You can see where there are, you know, barriers and they have moats and stuff. But this is like the old Como Zoo, if you used to go there, that I actually had to stop going to because it made me so depressed. The animals were in these little cages and you could just smell them and it just, they didn't look healthy. And that's what Rilke is seeing is this panther, a beautiful animal, just a beautiful, powerful animal, pacing back and forth, just tired, right? He's saying the panther's vision is so weary, it can't hold anything but those bars. That's all that he can see are those bars. It's the reality that's right in front of him, just keeps pacing back and forth. And his vision can't hold anything else, Rilke tells us. And the reason why, if you think about it, is he's already got 1,000 bars, right? Even if there's only 32 of them there, there's 1,000 from all the pacing that he does. And so he can't possibly hold on to anything else. He's already got 1,000 bars that he's holding on to, right? And this seems to me really a striking image about the things we hold on to, right? The things that are passing before us. So you think about our daily life, and there's this, and then 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 there's this. And we know what it is. It doesn't even have to be the exact repeated things, but there are the parameters of your life, and it shows up. There's the cat, he needs to be fed. There's the drive to work I need to do. There's the exit I need to take. There's my coworker I need to... And that's our reality. That's all we can see are those things that define the shape of our life. Those are the things we see. And we can't possibly let anything else in because we're holding on to so much as it is already, right? And there's a really wonderful, well-known story about a professor that visited a Zen master to learn about Zen. And those of you who go to the Wednesday night discussion group, you heard this. But it's a great story, and it's actually what got me to thinking about the poem, The Panther. The story, like I said, it's pretty well known, so you may have heard it, but there was a professor, he was interested in learning about Zen, so he went to the Zen master Nan-in, and Nan-in served him some tea while they were meeting to talk about Zen. So as Nan-in served tea, he poured his visitor's cup full of tea, and then he kept pouring. And the professor was watching this Zen master pouring, you know, tea just flowing over his cup. He watched it overflow until he couldn't handle it anymore. Finally he said, "It is over full. No more will go in." And Nan-in, the Zen master, said, "Like this cup, you are full of your own opinions and speculations. How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup?" And this is about approaching this teaching, right? But it's also about how we approach everything in life. When we're hanging on to stuff, when we hold on to those thousand things, we can't let anything else in. And those thousand things, I guarantee you, are filled with our opinions and our ideas and our notions about how life is and how it works. So we're holding on to that stuff, and we just can't let the whole world, in the way Rilke is talking about it, in. There's one other thing I want to say about the word hold. I won't do this with any other word, so you can be relieved. But I was looking at the German version as I was going through this English translation. And I was struck by the word hold because it looked like another word I knew in German. But the word that's in Rilke is Halt. It's H-A with the little dots over the top of it, umlauts, L-T. And that's just the third person present tense version of the word that is hold. But there's a dimension to that word hold that kind of interested me. Now, we have this as well, but in German, it's like, if you look this up in a dictionary, this is like one of the versions of the definition of the word hold that they have, which is holding an opinion. And the example that was given in the dictionary I looked at is, was hältst du davon? What do you think about that? What is your opinion on that? So hold has this quality of holding an opinion. Now, a panther can't hold an opinion. We wouldn't think of it, a panther as holding opinion. But we could think of that opinion about something as our expression of our understanding of what this is. And the panther is expressing his understanding in the weariness with which he's pacing back and forth. He can't help but express himself through those bars because that's the reality he understands. So that's how he expresses himself. And the other way that Halt means in German is, this is the one that I saw, but it had umlauts in it. If you've, you know, ever watched, I don't know, Hogan's Heroes or something like that, and one of the guards will go, "Halt," you know. So it means to stop. And that was actually kind of striking to me. I thought, is Halt also halt? And it is. It's the same sort of thing, present tense of stop. And what's interesting is what Rilke tells us is that his vision is so weary, it can't seem to hold anything else. The panther can't stop holding onto those bars. It has a momentum to it. It has a power to it. It has a trajectory to it. So he just can't stop thinking about it, right? It's what he thinks about. And think about our life, the stuff, again, that shows up in our life. It has a trajectory to it. We can't stop thinking about it. We can't stop it. It just keeps going. It just keeps going. So then I'm reminded of, I don't know if any of you saw the movie Phantom Thread. It was out a number of years ago. Paul Thomas Anderson, who's got a movie out right now. And I thought, what a strange title for a movie. What is Phantom Thread? If you see the movie, you know it's got a lot of meanings to it. But I looked up to see if that was actually a phrase and not just a poetic title. And it was a phrase. And it seems to me that it sort of describes very physically what I'm talking about here. So what phantom threads are referred to is they were threads that were sewn by Victorian era seamstresses in England. And these women worked hard. They worked hard and they were doing, let's see, Kaylee, you know it's like sewing all that stuff, right? The little sewing and sewing and sewing and sewing. And they were doing this, I don't know, 12, 16 hours a day. Probably had to do it really fast, sewing and sewing. And so there was a condition that was actually described that these seamstresses, some of them would suffer from, they would be afflicted by. And what they would do is they would continue sewing, these sewing motions after work, sewing like an invisible cloth with phantom thread. Right? It has this trajectory. We just keep doing that same stuff over and over. It has a life of its own that takes charge even when it's perhaps not apt, when it's not what we should be doing any longer. Now you're home. Don't need to do that anymore. But there you are. You've got the trajectory going. The pacing is going. And so this world that seems to overwhelm us, it basically possesses us. And it's a world that we've constructed. It is that world that right now the panther sees those bars. There's no denying the bars are there, but we also can't deny that there is a world beyond those bars. And so he's constructed this world. That's all he can see. And that's what we do. We construct a world that's limited by the things that show up in our life and how we put the world according to those. So Rilke continues, he says, as the panther paces in cramped circles, so think about that big cat in that little cage, pacing in cramped circles over and over, the movement of his powerful soft strides, like a ritual dance around a center in which a mighty will stands paralyzed. You get these phrases, powerful, soft strides. You've seen a cat, you know, even a house cat can be like this. My cat certainly kind of walks with this attitude, you know, but the stride of a cat and that soft, we know that quality. They can do stuff with their claws if they want, but otherwise they have the pads on their feet. And that mighty will that's at the center of the circle that the panther is walking in suggests that there's so much more to this panther than the languid creature that's tired and pacing in circles, imprisoned behind those bars. And then I'm reminded of zoo animals, again, thinking about zoo animals, and an essay that I read by the art critic and novelist John Berger. In his excellent book, you want to read a great collection of essays. It's called About Looking. And this particular essay, so if I remember correctly, all the essays are about things we look at. And he says, why look at animals? That's the title of this essay. And he talks about the quality of zoo animals and how they're really almost a different kind of animal than an animal that you're going to encounter in its environment. He says the animals isolated from each other and without interaction between species, have become utterly dependent on their keepers. Consequently, most of their responses have been changed. What was central to their interest has been replaced by passive waiting for a series of arbitrary outside interventions. So these animals, you know, the environment is there, that's what they are. That is, you know, and so what they do in the environment, how they live, that is, in a way, their purpose of being, is just to fully live in that. So take them away from that, and I'll wait for, and I know zoos have really worked on changing this, so this isn't meant to be a critique of zoos, it's just meant to talk a little bit about, you know, what's going on, and even the logic behind the zoo that creates these tired animals. But so they become dependent, you know, they're just waiting for the, you know, whatever it is that's their clue that food is coming. And then either they go get it or they don't go get it, right? But the zoo animals then are in a dependent relationship with their food, with their life. They're dependent on, as he says, these seemingly arbitrary outside interventions. Their life is not interdependent the way that it was when they were living in their environments, their natural habitats. Now, I say that a bit hesitantly because we're always interdependent. There's always interpenetration of all things. That's the nature of reality. But the situation that's created by humans for these animals is that they're separate. You know, so that interdependency, the situation that's set up is as if that does not exist, right? They become a separate creature. They're separated from their environment, and they're separated even from the world that immediately surrounds them by the pen or the whatever, the enclosure that they're in. All right. We are like that panther. We are like those zoo animals. So we are so much more than the exhausted creatures that we can be trapped by the bars of what we hang on to. We are so much more than that. You are Buddha. You are Buddha. You are always expressing Buddha. But the Buddha we're expressing doesn't always look like she's doing very well. Right? That's the problem. You're Buddha, but and you're always expressing Buddha, but the expression of Buddha doesn't always look so healthy. We're so often like that panther, engaged in that ritual dance. He says around a mighty will that stands paralyzed. But another way to think of it is the dynamic vigor of life. That center, that mighty will, which is the working, I think, totality that he's talking about. Can't get more mighty than that, right? The workings of reality. Let me think about that word ritual. The ritual dance that the panther is engaged in. When we think of a ritual, ritual can be a way that we can engage with what is more than what seems to be taking place right here. It can be very powerful. But it is a kind of theater. It is a kind of theater. I just went to a Rumanji last week and I was witnessing a ritual that was, you know, Jed and I talked about this, Jed was there as well, that really was moving. You know, there is a lot of power to it, but there is a lot of theater to it. There were costumes and there was music and there was chanting, you know, scripts, things that were said and things I didn't even understand because they were said in another language, right? And that ritual as theater then starts to have this, it's a little bit outside of what's taking place here. It's just its nature. And then what happens with that stuff happens in the theater as well, is the trappings, the thingness of the ritual can become just as lifeless as anything else, right? So if the ritual is intended to try to get us to open up to that that we usually close out, it can just as easily be something we get caught up in. So all the particularities of the ritual then become just more things that we hang on to. And it's real easy to do. I was watching those guys at Rumanji and I was going, that's a lot of stuff to remember, you know? And you can imagine if you do that over and over and over again, it just becomes, well, now I do this, and now I do this, and now I do this. And it becomes just like those bars. And the mighty will then is paralyzed. But, and I think there's a little bit of hope in this last stanza, even though I think there's some sorrow there too. Because remember, we get only at times, the curtain of the pupils lifts quietly. I'm going to talk about the image, the curtain of his pupils in a second, but it lifts quietly and an image enters in, rushes down through the tensed, arrested muscles, plunges into the heart. That happens. Of course, now with the panther, then, and is gone. And is gone. But first, that image comes in. The curtains of the pupils, they lift or part or however you want to look at it, and that image comes in. Awakening is available to everyone at every moment. You can see beyond the world you've constructed of the bars that are going back and forth, the stuff that you're holding on to. Right? You can see there's a world beyond that. Even while we're pacing behind the 1,000 bars, we can see that. We can feel that. And we can catch a glimpse of it. But now it's interesting because what Rilke says is that at times, quietly, the reason it's quiet is because we think that what Rilke's talking about, we open the curtains of the pupils. When we do that, it's going to be like, wow, you know, and it's going to be like, I don't know, the angels are singing in the heavens, you know, but it's quiet because it's actually just always here. You're putting butter on a piece of toast. Right there it is, you know? And that's why at any moment for anyone, getting that, seeing that, which in Buddhist terms, again, awakening, waking up to that is available to us at all times. Now, it's interesting, you know, we don't usually because it's so quiet. Instead, what happens is the image plunges right down. By the way, plunges into the heart because where else can it go? It's a complete opening up to the workings of reality, which are always right here, and you get that. It opens up for you. It's going to go right to your heart. But it's so quiet, we don't notice it. So our practice is to realize it, to start to pay attention to what's going on. And we can see, but in the meantime, you know, our eyes. So this is the way that I've been using this image all these years, I think about years. He says the eyes are curtains, but he says the pupils are curtains, which maybe is slightly better. I think this is important, though, because what Rilke's saying and what is good news for us, right? This is good news for us, is that the curtains aren't things that are put over our eyes. It's the actual workings of our eyes themselves, the pupils, the things that allow light in. That's what the curtains are. And pupil is a great image because they can get smaller and let less in, and they can get bigger and let more light in. Right? So in a way, that's really great. We can open that pupil up. Of course, we don't walk around opening our pupils up. But you know what I mean? Like they open and they close. And that is the curtains of our eyes. What are we closing out? What are we letting in? And sometimes they just open up, then right there, and we can see. So that curtain of the pupil set, you know, that it's always letting it in. Sometimes we can let that image in, it gets into our heart. And like I said, this happens. Happens to the panther. Right as he's pacing back and forth between the 10,000 bars or the 1,000 bars, 10,000 bars. But there's something interesting about those bars. Is when it opens, if the image didn't plunge to the heart and just go, something happens to those bars. They don't, I'm just going to say something happens to them. They're not really there the way that they are for this panther. But we can wake up again right in the middle of 1,000 bars. We can see what's taking place. And what we are going to see really is how we've diminished reality. Right? How that 1,000 bars or the, you know, all the bars of your life, right? And how we hold on to them and can't let anything else in, how we're diminishing reality. We're diminishing what this is. And we're actually not. So I'm saying that and I'm going to pull that back because we're not diminishing reality. You can't diminish reality. But you can act and think and speak as if it were diminished. Like I was saying, that panther can't help but express the 1,000 bars while it's caught up in the 1,000 bars. But we can actually realize that the 1,000 bars don't have to limit us. They are not all that there is. We can wake up to what it is that's showing up, even like I said, within the 1,000 bars, what's our experience of this? And it could include frustration, boredom, resistance, but whatever it is, it's whatever is right here, where it is. Oh, I said it. What's the it? Yes, that's what it is. And there's a koan. I'm just going to go through this quickly. Koans can't be gone through quickly. But I'm going to tell the story because it's something to not to hold on to. But if you haven't heard this story, maybe it'll come back to you from time to time. If you have heard the story, you'll either go, oh, that one again. But if you do, oh, that one again, notice this is what we're talking about. Oh, that again, right? A friend of mine told me when she was a little girl, she was at Southdale Mall, which is a nearby mall, and she'd gotten a helium balloon from a clown. You know, I don't know why they were having some kind of a celebration. A clown gave her a helium balloon. And as she was walking away with her mom, the balloon escaped, and it, you know, went all the way up, and she started crying. And so her mom said, oh, we'll get you another balloon. So they went back to the clown, and the clown said, oh, you again, which my friend remembered well into her adulthood, right? So just think about that experience of reality. Oh, that again. Do you know what I mean? Like how close that is, right? So if you've heard this before and you go, oh, that story again, just pay attention. This is what we're talking about. This is a story about a monk who goes to the great Chinese Zen master, Joshu. And he asks Joshu what the meaning of Zen is. And that's just, we say, that's what's the meaning of life? You know, what is the meaning of Zen? And Joshu said, the cypress tree in the yard. That's the meaning of life, the cypress tree in the yard. And the monk goes, teacher, don't use an object to guide people. And Joshu said, I'm not using an object to guide anyone. And the monk said, well, then what's the meaning of Zen? And Joshu said, the cypress tree in the yard. Now, this version, I'm going to tell you, keeps going. So if you've heard the story before, maybe it stops there, but this one keeps going. So imagine now, you're watching a movie, cut to another scene. As Zen master Guizhong went to Hogan's place, and Hogan asked, where have you recently come from? And Guizhong said, Joshu. Hogan said, I hear Joshu has a saying, the cypress tree in the yard. Is it so? Guizhong said, no. Hogan said, everyone who's been around says a monk asked him about the meaning of Zen, and Joshu said, the cypress tree in the yard. How can you say no? And Guizhang said, "The late master really didn't say this. Please don't slander him." Now, if you understand what that is saying, then you're seeing how it is that what we do with this world that is made up of these things, how we don't realize that that's not the limit of this experience, right? That they are expressions of the universe. They are expressions of totality. But it's interesting to me that when asked what Zen is or what reality is, that Joshu said, "The cypress tree in the yard." And that monk, he'd been studying, he's a monk. He went, that'd be like saying, it is a little strange, what's the meaning of life? Well, the tree in the front yard, you know. But then maybe you'd go look at the tree and go, I don't understand. Of course, missing Joshu's point. If you're going to do it that way, go to the tree and start looking for the meaning. That's not what Joshu's pointing out. So the student goes, well, I know better than, it's not some object. And he tells Joshu why he's going to reject his answer. And then Joshu insists, no, it's the cypress tree in the yard. So if we're going to get caught up in that thing, we get caught up in the cypress tree in the yard. We miss what Joshu is actually pointing to, which is why Hogen, who had heard that Joshu had this teaching, why he keeps pressing Guizhang. Well, I heard he had this teaching, cypress tree in the yard. But Guizhang won't settle there because he knows what Joshu was pointing out to, right? Which is that we can open the curtain of our pupils to see what's actually taking place and not to miss it in plain sight. That's it. It's kind of a nice little poem. I don't know if people have any comments they want to make, anything that's going through your mind, things you want to talk about, questions.
Thank you for sharing the poem. It just was meaningful to hear how poems can reverberate over time and relate to other teachings. I really appreciate it. And it was reminding me of that pupil image. I wasn't familiar with the poem. I've heard of the panther, but I had never heard the whole poem. It reminds me of the E.E. Cummings poem about this most amazing day. So that the E.E. Cummings,
yeah,
about this most amazing day.
Oh yeah.
And it ends with, now the eyes of my, or I think it's now the ears of my ears are awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are open, which, yeah, it feels like it's another way of getting at the ears of my ears and the eyes of my eyes.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to let my E come to home when I get home. Anything else? Yeah, Lois.
When the pupil is more open,
yeah,
more peripheral light comes in, so your picture is broader. And of course, when it's focused, you don't have that.
Yeah.
So that's.
Oh, that's great. You know, it is. It's the letting the whole in, the whole picture, as opposed to the little picture. You know, and we talk about single-pointed focus sometimes in Zen. And what we're talking about isn't, you know, this kind of single-pointed where you're getting done small. It's that seeing the whole picture is a single thing. And somebody was telling me that they were, I'm saying somebody was telling me this, but I have a feeling it was actually Richard Corner in a discussion group. He's on Zoom. That's why I gestured at the camera. But he was talking about sitting in a mall and just watching the movement in the mall, and eventually all of the movement became a movement. Like he started to see that. And that's that opening up the picture, not getting fixated. So yeah, thank you for sharing. Anything else? One last thing about Rilke. So he has a really delightful book, Letters to a Young Poet, advice that he wrote to a young poet. I've heard there's a new version of that coming out that has the young poet's letters in it as well, and that they really add some depth to Rilke's already brilliant letters. So if you're interested in something like that, keep your eye out. All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.